Thank you very much, Ivers. Thank you all for coming out. Great pleasure to be here. Thanks to the MAA for the invitation. I'm here to tell you a little bit about two things that are meeting tonight, and that is Martin Gardner's Legacy and Math Awareness Month, which just launched this morning. So as Ivers mentioned, I write card column for the MAA, and that's generally, if you Google that, you'll find me. I'm on Twitter at that, and that's my webpage and so on. And, Mathematics, Magic, and Mystery. Now, that happens to be the title of a book, and this is what most copies look like these days. But this is what it used to look like when it first came out, and it's been in print continuously since the middle of 1956, and it's Martin Gardner's second book that was published. The third one he wrote, the second one that was published. So that kind of is the impetus for Mathematics Awareness Month. And it has its own website, and its own Twitter handle, and its own Facebook page. And the Facebook one is a little hard to remember, but if you just Google, you'll find it pretty quickly. So we'd encourage people to spread the love for mathematics, especially throughout the next month, by taking advantage of the social media opportunities. Here's the wonderful poster that Bruce and Eve Torrance put together. Sadly, as Ivor said, they can't make it here tonight because of car trouble. I really was excited to have them here so they could bask in the glory of this. They put this poster together about 6 months ago and then came up with various activities that go with it, which I'll talk about in a moment. Now, Martin Gardner's book, which was written in the mid-50s, was old school magic. Simple stuff, no iPhones, no iPads, no batteries. Dice, magic squares, disappearing area puzzles. Card tricks, very basic stuff with rope and string, but yet very interesting. So in a sense, I think Mathematics Awareness Month, by taking advantage of some of the wonderful material he left us, is moving us forward into a new century and giving us more up-to-date multimedia versions with video and so on of many of those things and more recent ones that didn't exist when he wrote the book. This might be a good time to introduce the committee to you. Bruce and Eve Torrance, who should be here tonight but sadly can't make it, they're at Randolph-Macon College, not too far from Richmond, Virginia. And this picture was taken at a joint math meeting in Baltimore recently. So they did 99% of the work on the website. And maybe we should just take a quick peek now at some of the things that are on the website. So this website launched this morning at about 8:53. There was a minor glitch. It was supposed to go up a little bit earlier. But here it is. And it's kind of an advent calendar for people who believe in mathematics. So for each day of the month of April, there is a little box. There's a 5x6 grid here, and this is the first. And this is active today. And tomorrow, this one will become active, and the older one stays active. So as the week and the month progresses, they will all become active. But right now, the general public can only look at the first one. But I'm going to give you a sneak preview of three or four of them, because I have some insider contacts. So it's a great website, and this website is actually housed by the AMS, and they have done a tremendous amount of work in making 30 different web pages available, plus all the auxiliary materials, so hats off to them for helping out. So let's take a peek at, if I click on this one, you're going to see the first activity. And the first activity to launch Math Awareness Month and really set the tone this year is a ninth grader as a teacher. Ethan Brown is a remarkable ninth grader. He is a protege of Art Benjamin's. If you know Art Benjamin, he does mental calculations, magic square things at a pace that most of us can't handle. And Ethan does this too, and he's a ninth grader. And I've known him for 2 years. He is in Phillips Academy in Andover, Massachusetts. And this unveils a video here where he talks about where he does a magic trick. This is from a cabaret performance he did a few months ago. He's quite the stand-up comedian, stand-up mathematician. But here's a shorter video I'll show you just a little bit of where he explains how he does it. And he does one very quickly. Hope this loads.
Let's start with a really basic type of thing. Magic square. First I'll present it and then I'll show you guys how you can go home and do it. Just very little practice actually. So let's start. Can one of you guys give me a number from say 40 to 100?
51.
Hold on a second. If you look at that, every row, column, diagonal, the groups of four, the four quarters, they all add up to 51. Here's how you do that. You start by knowing B these 12 numbers here. Those 12 numbers are always the same. No matter what grand total number they give you, you always start with those 12 numbers. And it's actually really easy to remember this, if you think about it. Because if you look here, you have 5, 4.
So, how's the volume on that? Not great? Not too bad, okay. But so each page starts with a video. That's actually the second video there where he explains how he does it. But we can take a look at this insider preview, which is this one. This is the second activity, which is tomorrow. And this is James Tanton, who does a lot of outreach for the MAA. He couldn't be here at the moment. I think he's in Thailand, actually. But it's about braids. This is something Martin wrote about back in the 50s. In fact, Martin wrote about this back in the 40s. So let's take a quick look. Maybe this is just a minute and a half.
G'day. Here's a little mystery about braids. In order to make a braid, one usually takes three strands, connected at one end, say at the top here, the other three ends loose, and do the following. You take the rightmost strand, cross it over to the middle, bring the leftmost strand, then cross that to the middle, and then the rightmost and the leftmost, and you alternate, down you go. And that makes, as we can see here, a nice, beautiful braid. So then, we made very good use there of those three ends at the bottom being absolutely loose and free. So using this object, which has three ends attached to the top and three ends attached to the bottom, should be quite objectionable. It should be impossible to braid this beast. In fact, no loose ends, can't do it. I just used a bit of felt here, cut two slits, and I'm trying to braid that, and I say, why bother trying? It can't be done. Because clearly, this object here does not exist. There is a braid, three strands going all the way down, with the bottom three ends still attached to each other. In fact, this is quite stable. I can tug it, doesn't fall apart. In fact, it's quite beautiful. There are no twists in the individual strands. Each strand is basically facing forward. That's why I drew these black lines on it, so you can see that. So there we are. There's a braid with no free ends, which clearly cannot exist, despite it being right there. There is a mystery.
So the idea is to get people engaged and then go back and explain how it's done. And then depending on the mathematical level you want to go into, there's more detail. That obviously ultimately ties in with some algebra and topology. But it's the web page progresses in level of difficulty, so younger folk can understand how to do it, and maybe people who know a little more mathematics can delve a little deeper. Let's take a peek at this one here, which is about the golden ratio. Now, Keith Devlin, who also has a column for the MAA, is your go-to person if you want to know what is and is not true about the golden ratio. But rather than click on that, I'm going to show you a little clip here from an amazing woman called Vi Hart. She contributed one of the videos here. Vi Hart is about 25. She does not have a math degree, but she is one of the most effective communicators of mathematics. She made a sequence of videos on hexaflexagons a year and a half ago, and they got 8 million hits. Most of the stuff we do doesn't get made in this 8 million hits in the math world. So this is typical of her style.
So you're in your math class and your teacher's talking about, well, who knows what your teacher's talking about. Probably a good time to start doodling. And you're feeling spirally today, so, yeah. Oh, and because of overcrowding in your school, your math class is taking place in greenhouse number 3, plants. Anyway, you've decided there's three basic types of spirals. There's the kind where as you spiral out, you keep the same distance. Or you could start big, but make it tighter and tighter as you go around, in which case the spiral ends. Or you could start tight, but make the spiral bigger as you go out. The first kind is good if you really want to fill up a page with lines, or if you want to draw curled up snakes. You can start with a wonky shape to spiral around, but you've noticed that as you spiral out, it gets rounder and rounder. Probably something to do with how the ratio between two different numbers approaches one as you repeat until they have the same number to both. But you can bring the wonk back by exaggerating the bumps, and it gets all optical illusion-y. Anyway, you're not sure what the second kind of spiral is good for, but I guess it's a good way to draw snuggled up slug cats, which are species you've invented just to keep this kind of spiral from feeling useless. This third spiral, however, is good for all sorts of things. You could draw a snail or a nautilus shell, an elephant with a curled-up trunk, the horns of a sheep, a fern frond, a cochlea, and an inner ear diagram, an ear itself. Those other spirals can't help but be jealous of this clearly superior kind of spiral. Better draw more slug cats. Here's one way to draw a really perfect spiral. Start with one square and draw another next to it that is the same height. Make them... Say your name in your math class and teacher's talking about. Well, who knows what your teacher's talking about. Probably a good time to start doodling. And you're... It's clearly superior kind of spiral, but I draw more slug across the diagonal if you want a nice smooth spiral. Have you ever looked at the spirally pattern on a pine cone and thought, hey, sure, a spiral's on this pine cone? I don't know why there's pine cones in your greenhouse. Maybe the greenhouse is in a forest. Anyway, there's spirals, and there's not just one either. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 going this way, or you could look at the spirals going the other way, and there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. Look familiar? 8 and 13 are both numbers in the Fibonacci series. That's the one where you start by adding 1 and 1 to get 2, then 1 and 2 to get 3, 2 and 3 to get 5, 3 plus 5 is 8, 5 plus 8 is 13, and so on. Some people think that instead of starting with 1 plus 1, you should start with 0 and 1. 0 plus 1 is 1, 1 plus 1 is 2, 1 plus 2 is 3, and it continues on the same way as starting with 1 and 1. Or I guess you could start with 1 plus 0, and that would work too. Or why not go back one more to negative 1, and so on. Anyway, if you're into the Fibonacci series, you probably have a bunch of memories.
So you can probably tell, Vi has a lot of energy, and she crams a lot of stuff into her videos. But they're tremendously popular, and I think, you know, as we'll learn shortly, Martin didn't have an official background in math, and yet he turned on so many people to mathematics. Vi, theoretically, does not have a background in math, although her father's a well-known mathematician. But she didn't take any math in college, and yet she's making a lot of waves and getting people into math. There's a lot of different things here. There's card tricks. I think Thursday of this week there'll be a card trick which is connected to the Fibonacci numbers. There's quite a few. Ron Graham is doing stuff. There's a wonderful juggling one here which you definitely take a look at. Colin Wright is just unbelievable. Watch this.
Hi. Juggling and maths? Yes. When people find out that I can juggle, the first thing they say is, I can do two. And they usually do this. Two balls in a circle. Easy to understand, easy to do. The problem is, when you try and do three in a circle, much harder. And you can tell that just by the sound and just by watching my hands moving faster than humanly possible. But that's not the easy way to juggle three. The easy way to juggle three is to have one in each hand and one in the air. As the one in the air comes down, you throw the next one. Always having one in each hand and only one in the air means that you really have plenty of time. The difficulty is the accuracy of the throw under pressure. And if you want to learn to juggle, it's that accuracy of throw under pressure that you need to practice. But that's not all that you can do with three. There are many, many things you can do with three. You can do simple things, like this, slightly more complicated things, like this, weird things, like this, even through to the apparently complex and impossible, like this. And that's where the maths comes in, to understand all of the possible variations on three, and possibly more, balls, clubs, and more. And that's what we're going to investigate. The patterns in the patterns.
Okay, I'll show you one more clip, and this is an optical illusion that's been very popular in various web pages over the last year or two. Have to be seen to be believed, and those are made by Bill Ritchie of ThinkFun. I think you have some templates. There's templates outside here, and they'll be downloadable from the web soon too, so you can try making those yourselves. Okay, so that's some sneak preview. We have John Conway teaching people how to figure out the day of the week for any day in history. We've got Ron Graham connecting card shuffling with the Mandelbrot set, all sorts of good stuff. Now, let's go back to this on full screen and stay there for a while. Okay. So this is a photograph I took of Martin the first time I visited him, which I think was about 2006. He was camera shy, did not like having his picture taken. And in fact, if you look at the photograph you see on the back of some of his books, he looks a little unhappy. You might even think a little grumpy. He kind of froze when a camera came out. He was a very shy man. But with some reluctance, he agreed to pose in front of this bookcase because I realized that this was a bookcase, not of books that he read, but of books that he wrote. There's actually six shelves. You only see four of them there. So this is really a picture of Martin Gardner standing by every word he wrote. He wrote over 100 books. And in fact, he wrote 22 books in the last 10 years of his life, starting at the age of 85. 22 books between 85 and 95. So there's hope for all of us. If you haven't written that many books yet. Here are some interesting comments. Martin was very big on the kind of stuff I just showed you, fun as a motivation for learning mathematics. In fact, he said the best way to make mathematics interesting to students and laymen is to approach it in the spirit of play. And he was very fond of games, puzzles, magic tricks, jokes, paradoxes, models, or other things, which he says dull teachers tend to avoid because they seem frivolous. Maybe that's a mistake to avoid that. Ethan Brown, who you already saw here, says that he draws inspiration from Martin. And, he blogs every week. He's been doing that for a while. And he's certainly inspired by Martin. And in a review of Martin's memoirs, which was written in the Wall Street Journal, I think it was around New Year's, Jordan Ellenberg, who'll be speaking here in June, said that Gardner instinctively understood that mathematics was bigger, richer, and more fun than what's usually allowed in class, and did more than anybody else in the past century to get that message across to the public. As a instructor myself, I know how bound we are to the syllabus, and we feel we've got to get the stuff out and into the students' brains, but maybe we need to find a way to take a little time out and also bring some fun into the classroom, because maybe the students will respond better to material we're trying to get them to learn. Now, Martin's writing was largely non-fiction. He actually started in the late 40s after spending 4 years in the Navy and placed some stories in Esquire magazine before he moved from Chicago to New York. And one of those was called The No-Sided Professor, and you can guess what that was about. It was a topological twist story, so to speak. It was a science fiction yarn. And he wrote some articles, including ones on braids and mathematical magic and recreational mathematics for Scripta Mathematica, starting, 66 years ago. And ultimately, those became embellished and fleshed out as Math, Magic, and Mystery, the book that I mentioned. That came out in the middle of 1956. He's most well known, of course, for what he started writing at the end of 1956, and that was the Scientific American columns. They were called Mathematical Games, not a name he chose, but the editors chose that name, coincidentally sharing his initials. He wrote pretty consistently for 25 years and inconsistently for a few more, and they're available in 15 books. They're also available in one handy-dandy MAA publication. This is a searchable CD-ROM. It's a PDF of all of the books. So rather than going through the index of 15 books looking for something that you remember seeing in there somewhere, you can find it in a flash, so to speak, on this. It's a great resource. Every student, every library, every school should have one. And those 15 books were called The Canon by Don Knuth. The kind of things he introduced people to would include hexaflexagons. That was his first big column for Scientific American in late 56. The Soma cube, that's a 3x3 wooden puzzle you have to assemble, a 3x3x3 cube. Reptiles, tangrams, polyominoes. The Art of M.C. Escher. M.C. Escher read Martin Gardner's Annotated Alice, which came out in 1960. He was a big fan of Alice. He wrote a fan letter to Martin Gardner. He said, "I love your Alice book. Would you like to see some of my etchings?" Martin said, "Oh, I like those." And June of 1961, front cover of Scientific American. Almost, it's so psychedelic looking compared to anything that was shown on the front cover of Scientific American before, an Escher print. So he introduced Escher stuff to people outside the Netherlands, certainly. Conway's Game of Life, the four-column map problem, more to say about that later. RSA cryptography, he got in trouble for going public on that in the late 70s. And back in the news again today. Paradoxes. I remember the All Crows is Black one. In fact, I still use it when I'm teaching induction to students. So Unexpected Hanging became the name of one of his famous books, Non-Transitive Dice. He just loved mystery, puzzle, magic, math, the fact that it all fit together. And he's the one who kind of put them all together. This is a great book cover. Well, it's actually the illustration used for a book cover. The first Martin Gardner book I ever bought in Dublin, in 22nd of November, 1975. And here it is, more mathematical puzzles and diversions. And it shows, in a more colorful way, the same picture here, which is, how many pieces can you get out of a donut or a bagel or a torus by chopping with three planar cuts? What's the biggest number? And the answer apparently was not well known. I'm not sure who came up with the answer. I won't tell you what it is right now, but let me just say it's a lucky number. I'll leave it at that. Here's a puzzle which I have mixed views about, but let me just show you the puzzle first. Two missiles speed directly towards each other. One at 9,000 miles an hour, another at 21,000 miles an hour. They start 1,370 miles apart. Already you're reaching for your slide rule, I can see. Without pencil and paper, and this was pre-calculator era, in the 60s, the question was to figure out how far apart they are 1 minute before they collide. Now that 1,317 number is certainly troubling. And, well, one thing is obvious if you know a little physics, and that is if two things are moving towards each other at two speeds, you should add the speeds to find the relative speeds. So they're plunging towards each other at 30,000 miles per hour. It turns out the solution to this is pretty easy, because you know, the simple formula connecting speed, distance, and time, a minute is a 60th of an hour, so without any calculator, you quickly deduce that they were 500 miles apart a minute before they collide. And you suddenly notice that you haven't used the 1,317. And you feel cheated and disappointed, and maybe mad at your teacher. Well, that's how kind of, I thought it was slightly silly when I first studied it. But the more I think about this, I think it's actually a great service to people to give them problems like this, because the real world isn't as, you know, convenient as the problems that we cook up for students. We always make it so they have exactly the right amount of information, not a shred more, not a shred less. And maybe we're doing them a huge disservice, because when they go out to the real world, they're going to be faced with massive amounts of data, especially these days, and they need to learn to pick and choose and figure out what's important, what's not important. So maybe we should have a problem like this every week in our classes, or maybe once a month, or maybe once a year. But if you teach a student for 4 years and always shield them from this, I think maybe you're making a mistake. So I actually like your problem. The more I think about it, the more I like it. This was actually one of the ones that was used on NPR's Car Talk. They used to introduce their shows sometimes what they called puzzlers, and they frequently borrowed them from Martin and didn't acknowledge that until after he died. Here are some comments about his influence. As Ron Graham says here, there's no question that more than anybody else in the world, he was responsible for turning people of all ages onto the pleasures of mathematical recreation. Many have tried to emulate him, but few have succeeded. And Martin says, you'd be surprised how much there is to learn from starting with something as simple as an apparently trivial brain teaser. Knuth also says that Martin probably taught more people more good mathematical ideas than any other person in the history of the world. This is a man we should be, you know, paying more attention to. And as Martin says, there are thousands of entertaining tricks with cards, dice, coins, belts, and braids, and so on, which require no sleight of hand because they're based on mathematical principles. And that's one of the messages we hope Math Awareness Month communicates. Martin, of course, was also a skeptical American, as well as writing for Scientific American and being a Scientific American. His first book was called Fads and Fallacies in the Name of Science. And somewhere here we have the first edition. I think it's over there. But it came out in 52. Nobody paid too much attention to it. It didn't have the right title. It was republished by Dover in 57, and it gave it a better title, and suddenly it took off. And that's been in print ever since. And he's now considered to be the father of the skeptical movement. Isaac Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke and all sorts of people, Carl Sagan, had a very high opinion of him. And, you know, Martin himself makes a valid point here. I get impatient with pseudoscience, and I think, oh, it's just so silly, why waste time on it? But Martin says it's our duty to make sure that scientists do debunk bad science. Don't just assume that people are going to get it. You have to teach people, and that a democracy only works well when citizens are enlightened voters. I don't think anybody would question that. So only harm, Martin says, would come from an electorate that was voting going on across the road, or was until very recently today, unable to tell good science from bogus science. He was a founding member of PsyCop back in 76, joining forces with Asimov and Sagan and Ray Hyman and Paul Kurtz. And actually, one of the very last things he published was called Oprah Winfrey, Bright But Gullible Billionaire. And if you Google that phrase or any part of it, You'll find it. It's freely available on the Skeptical Inquirer website. But he was upset that Oprah was promoting bad doctors, fake doctors, people peddling what he considered to be snake oil. And he actually has some stronger statements to the effect that people have died because of turning away from traditional medicine and buying into some of this stuff that he considered very silly. Now, some people have a negative association with the word skeptic or skeptic. But actually, Martin was skeptical about things that needed to be skeptical about, but he was not a skeptical or a cynical person at all. He was actually a wondrous American. He was very amazed with the universe. And he loved imagination and fantasy, and The Annotated Alice was actually his bestseller. He himself is on record as saying that it sold over a million copies between all the different translations. Next year is the 150th anniversary of the original Alice in Wonderland, so there's going to be a special new version of Martin's annotation for that. He found wonder all over the universe, and he shared his toys and his hobbies generously. And I think this marks him, sets him apart from a lot of other people. The first time I saw him, he said to me, you know, since I was a child, it has baffled me or fascinated me that the moon and the sun appear to be the same size on planet Earth. So we get the eclipse phenomenon, that option. He just thought that was an amazing universal coincidence, as a 7-year-old and as a 92-year-old. So, you know, he didn't lose his sense of wonder at all. He was not an atheist, curiously, and I say curiously because a lot of people assume that he is, and a lot of people in the skeptical movement might be, but he wasn't. He wasn't an introspective, tormented soul. This is a pretty good quote. He was a searcher, an investigator, a magpie, and an enthusiast. And here's his own, one of many quotes he has that are not as well known. He said, if God creates a world of particles and waves, dancing obedience, mathematical and physical laws, who are we to say that he can't also cover the surface of a small planet with many features? That's a little less typical of the quotes of his that you see, but I think it's fair. It's important to the balance representation. Now, he was a magician. In fact, he started publishing when he was 15 and a half in the spring of 1930. And his last publication was exactly 80 years later. Amazing. A span of 80 years. Excuse me, is there a bottle of water? Thank you. His magical interests, he didn't do big-scale illusions. He did small-scale illusions, close-up, hard work. Yeah, published a lot for about 30 years on it. And then, you know, got involved in the Scientific American stuff and writing a lot of books about physics and philosophy and so on. And didn't publish a whole lot in it again, but he did perform very briefly as a student in a department store in Chicago for Christmas. But thank you. But he didn't consider himself to be a performing magician. But he left us a lot of good magic. Two very large books in the 500 to 600 page range, like the telephone directory, the Encyclopedia of Impromptu Magic, and Martin Gardner Presents, or is it Martin Gardner Presents? Every time I'm stuck for an idea for a card column, here's my secret. I open that book up, and I leaf through about 10 pages, and I go, aha, thanks, Martin. Another present from Martin, and I dress it up in a new way, and it becomes a new card column. So I've got a lot of ideas from that book. He was named at the end of the last century as one of the most influential magicians of the 20th century, and also got a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Magic Castle in Hollywood. But he did say, I was never a magic performer. He always just performed privately. I consider myself fortunate in this respect. Had I taken the conjuring as a profession, God forbid I may never have become a writer. So maybe we should all be thankful that he didn't pursue conjuring full time. Now, we've talked about mathematics and magic in connection with Martin. But where's the mystery? Well, there is a mystery. It would be natural, given what I've told you, to assume that Martin was a math professor somewhere, had got a bunch of university degrees, and had the joy of teaching students and grading papers every weekend, and giving talks around the country and publishing in journals regularly throughout his life. Actually, that is not the reality at all. Martin's life was quite different. He was a journalist, and he famously said that he never took a math class past high school. So the man that some of the top mathematicians in the world credit with turning on more people to math than anybody in the history of the world never took a math class, it would appear, after high school. And in those days, there was no calculus in high school. This was 1932, he graduated from high school. So we're talking basic geometry, algebra, trig, stuff like that. And yet, he made such an impact in the world. He did have a university degree from 1936, but it was in philosophy from the University of Chicago. And as a freelance journalist, he didn't really have a regular job. I mean, he was kind of on retainers, and he got paid to write articles for Scientific American, but he didn't have to go to an office or dress up in a suit. In fact, he famously was invited to the premiere of 2001 A Space Odyssey by his friend Arthur C. Clarke. And the invite said, tux required. Arthur said, I'm not going in a monkey suit. So he didn't go. Didn't tell his kids about it until later. Boy, were they mad. He was an amazing teacher, but he did it all from the perspective of a pen and a typewriter. He had an old electric typewriter that he used right at the end, I'm guessing he did it in the 60s or 70s. He once told me that he never gave a lecture in his life, which I find hard to believe. And then he said, and I wouldn't know how to, which is just ridiculous, because he was such a smart guy. He might have been shy or nervous the first couple of times, like all of us are, but he would have been a brilliant speaker and lecturer had he taken that choice. He did publish from time to time in regular mathematics journals, but he didn't start until he was in his 75th year, and he started right here at the MAA. So if you haven't published a paper yet and you're under 75, there's still hope. There's still hope. In fact, he did a joint research article with Fan Chung and Ron Graham. It came out in Math Magazine in 1989, and won an Allendorf Award from the MAA for excellence in expository writing. Not bad for his first article, right? He continued publishing in College Math Journal and Math Horizons, I think a couple of other MAA journals, for the last 20 years of his life. So between 75 and 95, he published quite a bit in math journals. And those are linked from the MAA webpage and the Math Awareness Monitor. So you can find those pretty easily on your page. He won additional awards from the MAA and the AMS. He won the Trevor Evans Award and the Polly Award for a couple of those papers, and the Steele Prize earlier from the AMS for just services to mathematics, because he had done so much for the previous 30 years. He also won prizes from the Felix Institute and various other things. Got a couple of honor degrees. He was offered lots, but he just didn't like traveling, so he took one or two and left it at that. So he was honored plenty in his lifetime. But his own family didn't know about half these awards until they were cleaning out his drawers, and he just didn't tell them. He was just a shy guy. He wouldn't mention this stuff to his family. Modest man. Well, he was modest. In fact, he says that he didn't invent very many puzzles, that he just acted as a kind of a conduit. He got them from people, he shared them. But he gave credit whenever he knew who the source of the puzzle was. But he claimed he wasn't a good mathematician. It is true to say, I think, that he said none of his columns ever required calculus. Although he did learn calculus, and he actually wrote a calculus book in the 1990s, so updated an old calculus book in an interesting way. A book called Calculus Made Easy. He said the big secret of his success was that he didn't know much about math. He had to struggle to get things right. And if you talk to the people who worked with him, giving him ideas, Conway and Knuth and Saul Gulam and so on, they will tell stories about how Martin would spend hours and hours and hours asking questions, and then he would go off and write this beautiful article. So he just had very good instincts and very good writing talents. So while he was reluctant to admit being a mathematician or a magician, he certainly was proud to be a mysterious. And this is what he says in an interview from 98 that appeared in the spring of 98 Skeptical Inquirer. He basically says the human mind is more complex, even a cat's mind is more complex than a galaxy devoid of life. He says, I belong to a group of thinkers known as mysterious. And he names some other people who are in that group, Roger Penrose, Chomsky, they're still with us, and various other people. And he basically says, you know, life is just more complex than we have the brains to understand. This is very much paraphrased. But he writes about it at the beginning and the end of his memoirs, if you're interested. There's a lot more he had to say about that. So he was a mathematician, in a sense, and he was a magician, in a sense, and he certainly was a mysterious. Well, the Martin I knew was an older man. I mean, I met him when he was 91, I think, and for the first time we had corresponded and chatted on the phone, but when I first got to meet him, he was 91, he was still sharp as a tack, but obviously he was an older man. These are pictures from when he was younger. Well, the one on the left is actually a very good caricature of Martin, which dates from about 1936, I think. And he was famous for his bushy eyebrows. And it's kind of exaggerated, but it's quite amusing. And this picture on the right is actually still from a rare series of magic videos that he made for a television company in the early 1950s. They used to be available on YouTube, but somebody must have threatened somebody with a lawsuit, because there's not a trace of them left anymore. And they just disappeared. But that's one where he's it was like an Alfred Hitchcock show. He would do something and then say, and after the commercial, he would explain it. So he would do a magic trick, and then after the break, he would come back and explain how it was done. They were short little clips. I saw a couple of them a few years ago. But this is, you know, he actually had talents that aren't mentioned. And I was surprised when I looked at the autobiography to find that this caricature is not by him, but he was a very gifted cartoonist and draftsman. He drew very good caricatures of other people. This is one of him, and apparently we don't have a historical record of who drew this. But he had other interests. He was well connected. He was friends with, you know, Asimov and Nabokov and Salvador Dali, and the people he knew were amazing, arts and sciences. So you have to wonder what other things might he have done if he'd had a chance. He loved thrillers. He loved old Edgar Wallace thrillers. So maybe, you know, he could have taken a turn and had a different kind of career. Maybe he could have starred in a movie like The 39 Steps as Martin Donut with the love of his life, Louise Carroll. But no, it wasn't to be. They hired some other guy called Robert Donut, Madeline Carroll. But 39 Steps is what we should take right now. We're in 2014, right? So go back 39 years, what do you get to? April 1975, Martin Gardner wrote a column for Scientific American. That was an April Fool's column. And he was kind of the first person to do this in a so-called serious context. So nobody saw it coming, nobody guessed there was a problem. And the curious thing is, there were six things in here. I'm gonna show you three of them, briefly. He was tickled pink by the reaction. First of all, thousands of letters were sent to the Scientific American. But they all said something like, they all bought into five of the six arguments, thesis, and thought that one was a spoof. And different people thought different ones. Nobody realized that they were all spoofs. And there was no internet then, so you couldn't Google and check things so easy. You had to go to a library. And so he kind of got away with it. And he fessed up, I think, in July of that year. But an enormous amount of correspondence was generated, most of which he didn't respond to. He generally responded to correspondence, but on this occasion, there was just so much. He just said, they'll get the joke eventually. So this is one of them. And I remember reading this. It didn't typeset right, I'm sorry. It's supposed to be e to the power of pi, and the root 163 is supposed to be up there beside the pi. Sorry. And he claimed that it came out to be this exact whole number. Those are commas separating digits here. Now, if that were true, it would be amazing. And I think I know some gentlemen called Gelfand and Schneider who'd be very interested to know about that. But because it violates a theorem from the late 1920s. But it seems to be true. And if you had a calculator in those days, you wouldn't have one with more than six digits, probably, never mind eight or ten. It would, you know, well, to some extent, it wouldn't contradict it, but it confirm it. You probably need 12 digits or a little bit up there. 18 digits. Well, it turns out he attributed it to Ramanujan. But actually, Hermite had discovered it back in 1859. But Martin attributed to Ramanujan and put the date 1914 on it, which of course is his own year of birth. And now it is known all over the internet, which is never wrong as we know, as Ramanujan's constant. And that name has unfortunately got stuck to it, and Ramanujan really didn't have anything to do with it. But it does have something to do with some interesting mathematics. There are other numbers that have similar properties. It's very close to this number. It comes out to be 43.99999925.01. So, you know, unless you have a lot of decimals, you're going to miss that it's not a whole number. But it would be astonishing if it was a whole number. But it turns out to be connected to some interesting modular functions and algebra and quadratic fields. So there is some mathematics that you can spin off from this. He also, in the same column, had this wonderful drawing somebody provided for him that claimed that Leonardo da Vinci had invented the flush toilet. And again, there was no internet to search to find, you know, if that was true or not. So people tended to think, wow, amazing, what a talented guy. Speaking of which, you know, Martin had a great sense of humor. He was a prankster, and this is, I guess you would call this toilet humor. Here's a book you don't see every day. And I'm going to pass this around, and I hope to get it back at the end of the evening. The younger eyes in the room might need to be protected from some of the drawings in here. This is Ain't That a Peach by Dr. Milton A. Ray. It is a rude, crude, and lewd selection of stunt, shtick, and trick for the undiscriminating entertainer, which Martin co-authored with Mel Stover, an old Canadian magician pal of his who passed away also. And you don't see it very often, but it's quite amusing. It's not that old, maybe 10 or 12 years old. But it's stuff he'd been saving up all his life, and he thought, one day I'll put this out, and he did. So here's the impossible map. Now, the impossible map was come up with by William McGregor, that's a real person, a real name, and not Sue Martin, attributed to. It's got 110 regions. You wouldn't think it looking at it, but it's quite time-consuming to try to color it with four colors. Even with the help of a computer, it's quite computer-intensive. And this is before the so-called proof, the computer proof of Apple-Hackett, which was the next year, saying that every map could be four-colored. So at the time, people didn't know whether it was true or not. So we said, we've got a counterexample. And it was really hard to work with. And you can find it in one of his books here. It's in a couple of them, but it's certainly in that one. Well, it turns out it can be colored. And here's a coloring of it. But it's non-trivial, highly non-trivial, to come up with that coloring. Curiously, Apple and Hacken's proof reduced the set of possible ones to be checked to 1936 maps. 1936 was the year Martin got his bachelor's degree. So what would you remember about Martin? Well, he was a skeptic. He was a scientific American, a writer, and a scientific American writer. He was an annotator. He was a mortal, a mathematician, a magician, and a mysterian, and of course, a big inspiration to people all over the world. So if you pick out... William McGregor. Of New York came up with the map. No, William McGregor was one of his correspondents. I think he sent it to him at some point. I'm not exactly sure the details. There might be more information on the internet about that. It might even be true. We could look it up. But William McGregor is the name to remember. So if you look at those nine words I've highlighted here, they form this nice little matrix. And in fact, the new website takes Martin's life and tries to shoehorn it into nine categories. He was all over the place, so it's very hard to do it in a way that there's not going to be overlap and you're not going to leave something out. So let me briefly show you a little bit about the new website here. And then we'll be close to the end. So here it is. This is the new website. It went up about 10 days ago. And we have taken some nice images here of Martin. This is a wonderful image using Penrose tiles that Bruce Torrance, who is one of the organizers of Math Awareness Month, came up with. This is a great picture of Martin in battle with a pen. He was a writer, first and foremost, but Scientific American, of course, was central to everything we put. So we put that in the middle. He was a magician. He was a skeptic. There's a cartoon up there. We have annotator at the bottom with a picture of him looking at the Alice statue in Central Park, his autobiography representing the mortal side of his life. And if you hover over any of those, they flip over and give you links to various things. Like mathematician, you can go to Scripta, the Math Magic Mystery Book, the calculus book he wrote, his legacy. The annotations would include Casey at Bat, Chesterton stuff, Wizard of Oz, and writing. Well, just about everything he did was writing. So we've got fiction, bibliography, his correspondence, his verse. He wrote some verse. And religious and philosophical writings as well. So we hope this is a good resource and that people would enjoy checking it out. And the web address again is martin-gardner.org. It's on various sheets of paper. There's lots of handouts outside that you can take. So that's how we organize the website. So Martin may be gone, but his voice resonates. He's on Twitter. Did you know that? What would Martin Gardner tweet? And in fact, today is the second Twitterversary of this account. This account was launched on the 1st of April, no kidding, 2012, at the conclusion of the Gathering for Gardner in Atlanta, which was straddled April that year. It was a couple of weeks earlier this year. It's a conference that happens every 2 years in Atlanta in his honor. There's also a new Twitter feed, relatively new Twitter feed, going here since about Christmas, called mgardner 100th, which of course is about the centennial. Now, Martin, being a modest man, would never have tweeted about himself. So the What Would Martin Gardner Tweet is fun stuff about mathematics in the morning, and in the afternoon, excerpts from his memoirs. So you can actually track his life story by following that. And this month, he's tweeting about Scientific American Days, which for many people is the most interesting stuff. But the mgardner 100th, of course, isn't Martin's, so that can brag about the things he did. So that'll link you to articles and books and reviews and nice things people said about him and quotes about him, which he'd have been too shy to share. So they're both accounts I would recommend that you follow in addition to the MathAware one. His memoirs, as we've mentioned, came out. There's a copy right here. Came out published by Princeton. There are rumors that other people wrote it. He wrote it. He wrote it right before he died. And the manuscript wasn't in the best of shape, but they tidied it up and didn't have a chance to ask him how he'd like things tidied up, so they did the best they could. It's very nice. If you knew him, you'll enjoy it, because it's like talking to him for a whole weekend. He writes about his whole life, not just the parts he might be interested in. There's only about 10% of it that's about Scientific American Days, but he had a very broad life with lots of different interests. So it's getting time to wrap it up here, and I'd like to leave you here with a math puzzle, which is to wrap up this cube. So the goal is to wrap the gold cube in the blue paper. Now, let's also pretend that the paper is a different color on the other side. So maybe it's blue on the inside, and maybe it's red on the outside. So you are allowed to cut and fold the paper. So you could just try to scrunch it up and reach over the top, but if you do some computations with square root of 2 and diagonals, there isn't quite enough to meet. But actually, you're not even allowed to mess up the paper. You have to cut or fold along existing grid lines. Now, if you're let loose with the scissors, this shouldn't be a problem, because the grid is a 3x3 grid, and a cube only has 6 faces. So you could just hack it into 9 individual pieces, put 6 of them where you need them, and sell the other 3 on eBay, right? That's not allowed. In fact, the paper has to remain in one piece. You're allowed to cut, but it has to be connected at the end. And that makes it more challenging. Now, I found this a few years ago on a website with a Russian origin. And in fact, there it is. And it appeared in English on a very good website called Cut the Knot, Wrapping a Cube. That's where that nice graphic comes from. And quite recently, I was astonished to discover that it's actually in an MAA book in a slightly different form, this one. New Mathematical Diversions, which is the third Martin Gardner Scientific American collection. It's phrased a little differently, but it's essentially the same puzzle. So once again, we are humbled to learn that Martin had all the good puzzles decades ago. You can invent a new one, but often it's just a variation on one that Martin had already written about. I mean, the amount of stuff he got through in those 300 columns was just extraordinary. So this one goes way, way back. I'd like to thank the Joint Policy Board for Mathematics for making Math Awareness Month possible, the MAA, the AMS, SIAM, and the American Statistical Association. And of course, you know what those letters stand for, right? Mathematicians, annotators, Americans, magicians, skeptics, and so on. I think the letterhead's going to be changed tomorrow. So what is his legacy? Well, Richard Guy, who is 97 and a half and still doing very well. He was at the Gathering for Gardner recently in Atlanta, says that Martin brought more mathematics to more millions than anyone else. Keith Devlin says, there's only one person who towers above everybody else when it comes to making math accessible to wider audience. It's Martin Gardner. Percy Diaconis has a famous quote about him turning teenagers into mathematicians, and that's personal. That's personal, because Percy met Martin when Percy was 13, 1959, and Martin helped inspire Percy to later on pursue mathematics and statistics, in addition to his magical interests. And Peter Rentz, who has edited the recent MAA Cambridge series of some of Martin Gardner's books, said that Martin had a unique ability to say just enough and then let the reader carry things on as the spirit moved them. So he didn't hammer anything to death. Moving forward, here's another quote from an MAA person you might know the name of, Fernando Gouveia. It's hard to exaggerate the importance and influence of these books. Fascinating, useful, fun, historically significant. Time has passed, and a new generation that knoweth not Gardner has arisen. Now we can fix that, and we need your help to fix that. And we hope that the spirit of fun and the spirit of Martin that's living on through Mathematics Awareness Month will help bring fun and mathematics to a new generation far removed from the Sputnik days. I'm not sure what time you got here today, but just before the talk, we unveiled these bricks outside, and if you didn't get a chance to look at them, they honor Math, Magic, and Mystery, Mathematics Awareness Month, Martin Gardner, the three nice ones there together, his Scientific American Days, the Aha Moment, the Gathering for Gardner, his friend I.J. Matrix. There's a green sheet of a meeting with Dr. Matrix that another MAA author, Owen O'Shea, had last week in Atlanta, and a reference, of course, here to his autobiography. By the way, when he handed over his autobiography, the title he had on it was The Autobiography of a Mysterian. And the publisher thought that might be a little tough to sell, so they changed it to The Autobiography of Martin Gardner. And that seemed to make sense. So MathFest, Celebration of Mind, and Gathering for Gardner are all things that are coming down the road this year. MathFest in August, Percy Diaconis will speak about his personal experiences with Martin and why he thinks Martin's legacy is important as we move forward. October is Martin's birth month, and every October there are celebrations of mind, which are just informal to formal. It's up to you. Gatherings, 3 people, 700 people, it doesn't matter. It could be in a library, a church, an old folks home, a kindergarten. People getting together, doing fun, exploring Martin's legacy. It's not about him, it's about the legacy of writings that he left us. So we would encourage everybody to get involved, especially this year for the centennial, but every October. This is the fourth or fifth year, I guess, coming up here. And the next gathering for Gardner, which is a gathering of, you know, old friends of his, but people who are like puzzlers, magicians, mathematicians. The next one is happening in Atlanta in 2 years. You just missed the one that happened just now. Thank you very much. Thank you.